You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today I'm really thrilled to have on the show one of the preeminent economic historians to talk about the economic impact of the COVID pandemic. If you aren't aware of him, you should be. He's Adam Tooze, and his latest book is called Shutdown: How COVID Shook the World's Economy. His previous book, Crashed: How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World, is the best I've personally ever read on dealing with the Great Recession. Adam's a professor at Columbia University and director of the European Institute. You can learn more about him at adamtooze.com. That's A-D-A-M-T-O-O-Z-E. Adam, thank you so much for taking the time to be on today.
Pleasure to be on the show.
We've had the Great Recession. We had the Great Depression. This was a different type of economic calamity that shook the world. What was so different about this, as you relate in the book?
Well, it came from the outside, if you like. It came from outside the economy. I think that's really the thing that makes this very special, very different. Like normal economic recessions, they maybe have a trigger, but generally speaking, they come from the internal dynamics of the economy. So in 2008, it was a real estate crisis. The early 2000s, it was the tech bubble bursting. That's the kind of normal pattern. This turned into a financial crisis and the worst labor market shock the U.S. has suffered since the Great Depression. But it took the form of a health crisis, a public health crisis. And that triggered our general reaction and set in motion that panic. It's also unusual because it affected, as a result, all of the countries in the world effectively simultaneously. So over 90% of the world's economy were contracting in the first half of 2020. And we've really never seen anything like that before. So those two things, I think, really make it absolutely unusual. And it was incredibly severe. But that's a result, if you like, of the fact that it's a general comprehensive reaction to an external shock.
Were there warning signs something could happen this drastic to this type of health pandemic could occur and shut the economy down? Were there warning signs that our leaders perhaps didn't take seriously enough?
Really, of concerned public health commentary for almost half a century. I mean, the diagnosis of the potential of what's called emerging infectious diseases goes back to the 70s. It goes back to the beginning of environmental movement, for instance, as we know it today. It followed immediately after the great victories over smallpox and polio in the 60s and 70s, and public health experts, virologists, were warning that we hadn't won our battle with nature by any means. There were a series of near misses, the SARS epidemic of 2003, a lot of fear then about avian flu, then the swine flu pandemic fear of 2008-09. So yes, it's been there. And there were quite sophisticated analyses also of the potential economic damage, but they tended to assume that the worst effect would be in low-income countries, emerging market economies, with smaller economies, therefore. And what no one had really reckoned with was a comprehensive public health failure in the three largest hubs of the world economy, China, Europe, and the U.S., which account for 60% of global GDP. And that was really a complete surprise, because that's where, as it were, public health is supposed to work. And it turned out precisely in those places that it didn't.
If people weren't as aware, perhaps, of supply chains, global supply chains, and how they could disrupt the economy, they are now.
That also, I think, is a factor that, we talk a lot in sort of rather airy terms about globalization, but actually figuring out the way everything hangs together is almost as though it takes a shock for us to really join the dots, which we've obviously had to do in a hurry since the pandemic broke out. So I would agree with you in a sense that there was a way in which we underestimated that, the capacity for a shock to ripple out. And we've been dealing ever since with that, in a sense. It isn't just the first wave now, after all, but it's, as it were, the reverberating effects within this complex system of containers being in the wrong place and so on, that is still with us now.
This had so many impacts, as people know, and one of them that we found out I guess, as we experienced this, was the impact on inequality, which is already a big issue in the United States, and it it seemed to exasperate things. How bad was this, the impact on our economy, as far as inequality?
So if the shock had gone on unmoderated, if we had done nothing about it, it would have been catastrophic for inequality within the United States, because almost like a heat-seeking missile, it went after the most precarious, the lowest paid, the most fragile, the most stressed families and households in the country, right? So it affects sectors with very low wages. We know this because the average wage of workers employed actually went up during the crisis, not because, you know, they were being paid more, but because so many low-paid jobs were being cut out of the workforce that the average actually rose. It's a really perverse effect. And we know, of course, that it was much harder for families with bad housing conditions, crowded housing, without good internet access to cope with this crisis. So if we'd done nothing about it, it would have been catastrophic. But in fact, the national programs that were put in place in many of the rich countries of the world were so large that they, to a considerable extent, offset this. Of course, this is not to say that these were long-term solutions or that they spared people huge distress and uncertainty and worry. But if you look at how many benefits to earn a family, both parents becoming unemployed in the summer of 2020 could draw down from the federal government, it's completely unprecedented. And it fully replaced the medium income in large parts of the United States, let alone for somebody on a low wage. They could be in many ways quite substantially better off. This didn't work globally. So it worked within the rich countries, but it did not work globally. So at the global level, it is above all the poor and the middle-income countries that have been hit hardest.
Your book goes into a lot of not just economic impacts, but social impacts, cultural, political. One I thought found really interesting was how the previous changes in the structure and operations of hospitals in the United States impacted the response to COVID. Can you share that a little bit?
Yes. I mean, modern hospitals are like, many other modern institutions. They've undergone a kind of management revolution in the last half century. You know, they're some of the biggest employers in most American cities. So there's a huge pressure on them to optimize their performance in terms of efficiency. Many of them are privately financed, obviously. They are, in some cases, heavily leveraged with large amounts of junk bonds, so high-yielding bonds issued to finance their investment. And so these are, streamlined, just-in-time organizations too. And there are, well, it's worth saying, there are good reasons for this. It makes healthcare, believe it or not, somewhat cheaper. It doesn't prevent the escalation of costs in other respects, but it does, in fact, make it more efficient. And we know that, it's not actually good to warehouse recovering patients in hospitals for any longer than you absolutely have to, because they're unhealthy places. But it means that if you're going to manage this safely, you need to have a pretty good idea of what morbidity patterns are going to be, who's going to get sick, for how long, and of what diseases. And so a pandemic like this just completely upends all of those calculations and exposes the fact that you quite deliberately have minimized your excess capacity. You do not hold reserves of equipment that you don't regularly need in such huge quantities. And basically is quite capable of tumbling hospitals into sort of chaotic malfunction, which is what we saw notably in New York in March, where they were really clinging on by the skin of their teeth. It was obviously terrifying for everyone concerned, and they weren't really able to contain the spread of the pandemic within the hospitals in those awful first weeks. So, yes, there's a really an effect there. It's worth saying, though, I think that given the exponential growth of a pandemic, if it's out there in the population at large and spreading as uninhibitedly as it was in New York in March, you would really have to hold an unreasonable amount of reserve capacity in the hospital system to be able to cope. So, we were pretty close to the edge right from the very beginning. But even if there had been more reserve capacity, it's unlikely that it would really have avoided a crisis. It's just, when you have a rampaging pandemic that is hospitalizing a lot of people, reserve capacity is not in the end a viable way of coping with a problem like that.
You mentioned in the book that we mistook Wuhan for Chernobyl. Can you explain on that? I thought that was an interesting angle on this as well.
Yeah, early on in the crisis, it has to do with the kind of, just the coincidence that HBO had been running that dramatic and and much hailed series about the reactor incident in the Soviet Union in the 1980s. And when the COVID outbreak happened in China, there were a lot of people in China and outside believing that this would, as it were, be SARS but worse. It would be SARS 2.0. It would be much worse, and that would be, as it were, the death knell for the communist regime in the same way as we think Chernobyl was for the Soviet regime. And at that moment was revealed a kind of willingness to believe, that China's communist regime, for all its apparent strength, was actually underneath quite fragile and would rapidly lose legitimacy and collapse if it couldn't contain this epidemic. And that, of course, turned out to be a vain hope. I mean, at first, there's no doubt at all that the pandemic raging through Wuhan really did unsettle the Chinese population, and there was a huge outpouring of indignation and protest online over the treatment of some of the doctors that had been brave enough to blow the whistle early on in the epidemic, one of whom, of course, died very publicly. And his name and his image was widely circulated on Weibo, the Chinese social media hub. But the censors got hold of that. And then the regime actually managed to contain the epidemic in a way that no one else did. So they ended that story and put paid to that entire narrative. But it was very telling, it seems to me, that rather than thinking to ourselves, oh, wow, if this is happening to China, this could happen to us next. We better saddle up and actually prepare for this crisis that's coming our way. We put it at a distance. We said, this is like what happened behind the Iron Curtain in the 1980s. This is like what happened to a regime as alien and as distant from us as the Soviet Union was. Rather than thinking, oh wow, Wuhan has got hundreds of flights a week to other major airport hubs. From there, those flights connect to the rest of the world. There are direct flights from Wuhan to many major airports around the world. Oh, wow, if that's a problem for them, this should be a problem for us, too.
Obviously, China plays a huge role in this. This is where all the evidence points that COVID began. Still debate over whether the actual sources of it. It became more of a political issue under former President Trump. How's President Biden handling this now, how this fits into our larger relations with China?
I have to say, I was surprised that Biden indulged the idea that this was a lab outbreak and reopened the question and as it were decided that he would, as it were, keep that ball up in the air. It's not because it's not an entirely implausible theory. I mean, after all, it wouldn't be surprising if it had escaped from the lab. Nor would it shake our fundamental understanding that this is a problem of modern society. This is not an act of God. This is something produced either through dangerous mutation or through a lab accident, either one of which could, of course, be replicated all over the world, including in the United States, on any given day, in any given year, at any given point in the future. So we should be really paying attention. You can't, again, do the Chernobyl thing and say, oh, well, it escaped from a Chinese lab. It would never escape from one of ours, because we know perfectly well that that's not true. So on the one hand, I think it's not an unreasonable theory. It's just clearly going to antagonize the Chinese. And B, also clearly, we're never actually going to get to the bottom of this, because Beijing will never admit the possibility of an independent inquiry, any more, frankly, I think, than we would. I mean, if one imagined a pandemic had broken out, what is the chances of the United States Congress agreeing to a WHO or United Nations commission to come and rifle around the situation on the ground in the United States? It's a huge intrusion into national sovereignty, and no great power like the United States or China is ever likely to agree to that. So given those two facts, a realistic position, it seems to me, would be to say just downpedal, downplay this. As you were saying, it was also a theory, of course, hyped by the Trump administration. So in a sense, you're pandering to that constituency. Maybe that in the end is the logic, that it served as a kind of bridge, a bipartisan bridge. It's a little bit of a mystery to me, but it's consistent with, well, generally, the fact that the Biden administration has to a large extent continued the relatively aggressive, hostile positioning that the Trump administration adopted towards China in the course of 2020. They basically just sort of accepted the Trump defaults, you could say they haven't added much, as it were, tension. But by continuing those Trump policies, from the point of view of Beijing, of course, they are de facto raising the tension, because Beijing was hoping that Washington will dial it back when it returned to something more like normal, and that hasn't happened.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is author Adam Tooze, who's written a book. We're talking about his latest book called Shutdown, How COVID Shook the World's Economy. He's a professor at Columbia University and director of the European Institute. You can learn more about Adam at adamtooze.com. It's A-D-A-M-T-O-O-Z-E. And really, again, outstanding book he's written here. His previous one was about the Great Recession. I want to ask a couple questions about that in a bit. But getting back to this, where we're at. I mean, it seems like we're at this. It's a slog. It's maybe a little better than it was, but we still don't have a global solution. What are the prospects for one, Adam, and what have we learned to be able to cope for the next time this happens, which it will?
I think that is indeed the most depressing element of the story. And frankly, if I finished the book 6 months later, I would have concluded on an even more grim note than I do anyway, because it really is sort of enough to drive one to desperation, to be honest, because the pandemic, as you say, is still with us. In fact, it's with us in the United States. And if you're fortunate enough to live in the northern half of the country, then the pandemic is perhaps in the past. But, you know, only a couple of weeks ago, 2,000 people a day in this country were dying of this disease, and the hospital systems of states as far north as Kentucky were, on the brink of collapse as a result. So we're not done. Globally speaking, we're absolutely not done. And every single person that gets sick is the chance of, a variant emerging that's even more infectious or even more deadly than the Delta variant, which has caused such havoc this year. So, and astonishingly, we have the technical medical solution to this problem, which is the vaccine. And we know it works, and we know it's safe, and we have a whole suite of them at all different price points. And yet we do not actually have a concerted global effort, which is, as it were, the headline news every day with maximum political emphasis behind it, to get vaccines, at least an offer of a vaccine to every single person on the planet. It's within reach. We've managed to distribute, I think, 6 billion vaccine shots, but they're very unequally distributed. So, only about half the world's population is fully immunized. And that just exposes us to a huge risk. It's utterly baffling, because the cost of doing this, you might think it would be gigantic. By the standards of the world economy, it isn't. Somewhere between $50 and $100 billion, which, of course, sounds like a lot of money, but given that the world economy is $80 trillion plus, it's really very manageable. And the payoff from it, the IMF estimates, would be in the order of $10 trillion, which is gigantic. So it's literally like $10 trillion bill lying around on the sidewalk, a winning lottery ticket, and folks saying, oh, I don't have a buck, I can't afford the lottery ticket. And the person is handing it to you and saying, it's worth $100. And you say, oh, I can't afford it. It's profoundly irrational, very, very difficult to understand why there isn't a more direct push here. I'm not convinced that it's down to the interests of the pharmaceutical firms. I just don't find that altogether convincing as an explanation, because I don't actually think politicians have leaned on them hard enough and said, look, Pfizer, how much would it cost us to break your patent and, roll out production all over the world? I don't think anyone's even put the question to them. And until we put the question with real emphasis, rather in the manner of a question you can't really refuse, we really want to know the answer and please name a sensible price, until that happens, you can't really blame them for not agreeing to it, because they are, after all, profit-orientated, privately owned companies. So altogether, it's a mystery. You put your finger on really the most mysterious element of all of this.
I talked earlier about we spoke about how COVID contributed to inequality in the United States. It's also, again, in a bizarre fashion, and I think the world looks at us sometimes and can't believe it, but it also contributed to our partisan divide again. How did that happen? I mean, Trump's administration, produced the vaccine. He took it, but yet here we are arguing about that still.
It's absolutely mind blowing. Yeah, precisely because at various points, Trump, who is nominally the leader of that that show, was boasting of the fact that it was his vaccine and complaining about the fact that he didn't get the credit for it. And for heaven's sake, it works. And by all means, let's give him the credit. Like, you know, it's something good the administration did. I don't see any reason not, you know, to celebrate the fact that the Republicans are capable of doing good things, too. This is great. This is a good news story. It's not as though the Democrats opposed it, but, like, let's give them credit. It's money well spent. It was an excellent plan. And so it's absolutely mind-blowing. I agree that it's not possible for the GOP to you know, fully own this. I think it's a sign of the fact that what's going on in that party is very complex and sort of somewhat out of the control of any one particular individual. I think the idea that there's some sort of grand master plan there is really rather exaggerated. It doesn't add up like that. Grassroots opposition to vaccines is common across the world. I mean, it's common in Europe as well. But what is different is that you have, you know, the supposedly serious leadership of a supposedly serious party, and in a two-party system, like one of the two big parties, not consistently and loudly and publicly backing, you know, the necessity of immunization. So you've got 15 to 20% of the population that have weird ideas about it, conspiratorial fantasies and so on. You see that in Germany, you see that in Italy and France, practically all over the world. But that you see a major contender for power, like the Republican Party, not consistently coming out, and their media, you know, satellites, as it were, not consistently backing the message, that is singular. And you know, the closest analog amongst big countries is probably Brazil, which is in a similar mess. And it is indeed a shocking state of affairs and ruinous, right? It costs probably hundreds of thousands of lives, and it's really baffling, difficult to deal with. I feel very personally about this because my wife comes from Kentucky and she is split from her family over this issue, with the rest of her family refusing the vaccine and several of them becoming very, very ill. In fact, several of the people who have been vaccinated in the high Delta areas then getting very ill. And it's really, you know, and even then, the message doesn't get through. You know, when your dear uncle and grandfather are at death's door, it's still apparently the spark doesn't cross the gap. It's very difficult to digest.
As you're aware, Adam, in our region of the Midwest here, we've suffered from a lot of loss of manufacturing jobs over the year. This played directly into a lot of folks who had previously voted for Obama. We're also the location of the most Obama-Trump countries in the nation. And this is the region that arguably elected Donald Trump president, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. And I keep coming back, a major theme of my show is how do we get the economy reinvigorated? And with the loss of manufacturing jobs, I guess to tie all this together, is there an opportunity here to bring manufacturing back to some degree now that we see the issues with the supply chains and with microchips, with drug ingredients, whatever? Do you see manufacturing reestablishing itself in the United States the way it used to be?
I think there's certainly an opportunity for that. I'm not sure how far that's going to go, to be honest, given the complexity of the global division of labor and the relentless increase in labor productivity in manufacturing, which is, of course, one of its great triumphs, you know, historically, is that it's the zone where labor productivity has increased most. Whether one should really look to manufacturing as the source of new jobs, I think is, I'd be skeptical unless we really envision a huge investment push, which would, as it were, hugely change the balance of demand. And my personal, you know, vision there is very aligned with something like the Green New Deal or just generally Build Back Better, in the sense that Biden's infrastructure program, in that America patently needs an entire new generation of infrastructure. We urgently need to address the climate crisis. Many of the heartland states, both red and blue states, are extremely well positioned to be in the forefront of that push. And that's another, for me, inexplicable dimension of American politics in the moment. The refusal of the GOP to embrace this is a huge opportunity for many of the heartland states to be new energy hubs with wind and solar, and some of the infrastructure work that needs to be done could definitely employ a new generation of highly skilled blue-collar workers. And I fully sympathize with your sense that 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 is key to restoring a viable middle ground in American politics. Obviously, from a partisan perspective, I would hope very much that that was bridged by an expanded Democratic Party coalition in the manner of the New Deal. But frankly, you know, I would happily take a constructive conservative politics that embraced the challenges of the 21st century and simply said, you know, we recognize by all means of a religious coloration why this is not a matter of, as it were, stewardship for God's creation. It's always puzzled me deeply why that isn't a much stronger strand in American evangelicalism. Because again, you'd think it was an open goal, right? That this is, and in Europe, amongst conservatives, green issues are much, much more intuitively understood as being part of the mainstream of their agenda. I mean, why is there any contradiction here at all, in fact? So yes, I can see the attraction of your project.
Just time for one more question, and I just have it like in 1 minute. So, and this is going to be an interesting one. But you know, social media brings us so much. I mean, I'm able to follow you in a lot of your comments, and you put out a regular commentary. Do you feel social media was a net positive or negative in our response to COVID?
Very difficult to say, and the problem is, in a sense, because of social media, we all have such warped perceptions. I know that in my little bit of social media, it was a huge positive. I mean, gigantic positive. As you say, it just helps us to be smarter. It makes everyone smarter every day, in my particular bit of it. But that may be the problem, right? That it is balkanized. And so if you want to find a smart, expert, lively, global conversation, it's there. And it's there in a way that, you know, growing up in the 60s, 70s, 80s, we never had that. It's like a gigantic public library or the best seminar that you can attend in the world every single day. But I also understand that if you are headed off in a different direction into a more sort of closed media loop in which sort of endlessly confirms your own prejudices, and to an extent everyone's world, of course, does, and those are the bits you gravitate towards, you know, rather different things can happen. And so it can obviously be a reinforcer of, frankly, superstition and conspiracy theory and just plain nonsense. That, I think, however, one has to say, you know, is now tied up with, but it, you know, at root, you have to focus on broader educational processes. You have to, it's a very complex chicken and egg process digging mm-hmm. ourselves out of that hole. And I wouldn't necessarily blame the internet alone. I mean, before the social media, there were, after all, the shock jocks. And there was that entire, you know, undergrowth of radicalized radio in the 90s, basically, right? So it's been a while coming, and it has forces, and it has conditioning and causal forces beyond technology. But technology certainly can exacerbate and accelerate that process.
Very unfair of me to ask you to answer that in 1 minute, but I appreciate the job you did. It was very good. Our guest today on Heartland Politics has been Adam Tooze, who's an author. Of his latest two books are outstanding. I strongly recommend you get them, look them over, our listeners. The latest is called Shutdown, How COVID Shook the World's Economy. And read the book and follow Adam at adamtooze.com. Adam, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Pleasure to be on the show.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at wvik.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.